are listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Start your workday off. The Maria Sanchez Show. Current events, newsmakers, lifestyle, health, relationships, entertainment. Miss a day? Download the podcast at LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. We're heard here live every weekday morning. That's at LA Talk Radio, Channel 2, at 9 o'clock Pacific. And then later in the day, we post the podcast not only on LA Talk Radio, Channel 2, but also on MariaSanchezShow.com and the MariaSanchezShow.com. So thank you for joining us if you're listening live. And you can listen live. There are free apps to download the program or the opportunity to hear the program live to your iPhones, your pads, and your Androids. So please take advantage of that if you want to take us on the go. Coming up this morning, we have a guest who actually was clinically dead for 6 minutes in a coma for 6 days and told that he may never walk again, and he ultimately became an ultra marathon runner, Hall of Fame business achiever, and number one best-selling author. And he's going to provide us with inspiration, which is one of the things we love to do, is to provide hope and inspiration. So saying that all of us are capable of overcoming adversities to create extraordinary results. And then we also are going to have on the program later this hour a professional love coach and internationally selling author who's written a book called Breakups Are a Bitch, but Getting Over Him Doesn't Have to Be. And she's going to talk to us about that. And it applies to men and women. So if that got your attention, I hope it did. We've got several news stories to cover. But the one that's being revealed now, which it's kind of curious the timing is, it's getting all over the news this morning. And it's one of my worst nightmares, and it's the reason that I stopped being an organ donor. But after having the organ donor folks on our program, because of the little girl who needed the lung transplant, we wanted to kind of get that word out. And she assured me that, no, you have to be clinically brain dead and all that stuff. So I went ahead and I registered, and now my organs are available for donation. But there is a story about this woman whose name is Carolyn Burns. It was midnight. She opened her eyes, looked up at the operating lights above her, and she had the doctors ready to harvest her organs and donate them to patients on the waiting list. So apparently this happened in 2009, but the Syracuse Post-Standard unearthed a report from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services that chronicled the series of errors that led to the near organ removal of a living patient at St. John's Hospital Health Center in Syracuse, New York. So according to the report, doctors had inaccurately diagnosed her with irreversible brain damage and ignored the nurses who noticed signs that she was improving. She curled her toes when touched. She flared her nostrils and moved her mouth and tongue. She was also breathing on her own, even though she was on a respirator. She was 41 at the time and was initially found unresponsive and surrounded by empty bottles of Xanax, Benadryl, a muscle relaxant, and an anti-inflammatory drug on October 16th, 2009. She was hypothermic and had a weak pulse, but she was alive. So in the emergency room, doctors performed toxicology tests and determined that she was suffering from a multi-drug overdose. She was unresponsive and then put on the ventilator. So poison control specialists recommended using activated charcoal to stop her body from absorbing the drugs, but that never happened. Doctors couldn't get the tubes into her body, and so as a result, the report concluded it's possible that she continued to absorb the pills that she had ingested, but the doctors never did toxicology testing to find out. Now, again, this is a story that's the exception. So, you know, you can say, well, it doesn't happen very often, and it doesn't, and I'm going to say, yeah, I'm still going to keep my organs donated, but it feeds into my worst nightmare. So soon she was having seizures, and a subsequent head CT scan on October 17th and 18th appeared normal. Still, her EEG brain scans indicated poor progress, and on October 18th, doctors did a wait and see to see whether she would improve over the next few days. That same day, however, doctors told her family that her brain damage was irreversible and that she undergone cardiorespiratory arrest. So the family made the decision to take her off of life support and donate her organs the next day. She opened her eyes at the last minute, saving herself from the organ harvest procedure. And unfortunately, this poor woman committed suicide in 2011. The family never sued, and the family members told the Syracuse Post-Standard that Burns was too depressed to be upset about what happened to her at St. Joseph's. So feeding into my worst desire, there's a real true story about what happens when some things run amok. So one of the top news stories this morning is those three sweet women, Amanda Berry, Gina De Jesus, and Michelle Knight, who were kidnapped allegedly by Ariel Castro, posted a video yesterday on YouTube. It's a 3-minute, 30-second video. It shows each of them speaking independently, some of them referring to notes. But they came out and they said that the support and prayers of family, friends, and the public were allowing them to rebuild their lives after what Amanda Berry called this entire ordeal. They were smiling. They appeared upbeat. They are pleasant. They are actually fairly attractive in my estimation. Not that that means anything. So the video was filmed July 2nd and was released by a public relations agency on the women's behalf with the cooperation of their attorneys. And they also wanted to thank everyone for the outpouring of financial support. The Courage Fund, which was established to help them, has raised more than $1 million, and they said that it was allowing them to get back to a new kind of normal. Michelle Knight said, I may have been through hell and back, but I am strong enough to walk through hell with a smile on my face and my head held high. I will not let the situation define who I am. I will define the situation, and I don't want to be consumed by hatred. The women don't plan to make any additional public statements. They're saying, I'm getting stronger each day and having my privacy has helped immensely. I ask that everyone continue to respect our privacy and give us time to have a normal life. So that's another great story. Sad story is that the memorial for the 19 hotshot firefighters is happening later today. The memorial service is open to the public. And it's for the 19 young men who were a member of the Granite Mountain Hotshots, an elite firefighting squad from Prescott, Arizona, and they perished on June 30th. Again, the greatest loss of life from a U.S. wildfire in 80 years and the highest number of American firefighters killed in a single incident since September 11, 2001. So Prescott is a city of 40,000 people. It's about 60 miles north. West of Phoenix. The American Red Cross is actually deploying folks there. I have a dear girlfriend who was deployed over the weekend, and the American Red Cross is also helping out with this morning's memorial. So it's taking place at an entertainment and sports arena in the adjacent town of Prescott Valley, and they have set up overflow space to handle a crowd that's expected to exceed the arena's seating capacity of around 6,000 people. Vice President Joe Biden was slated to lead a group of dignitaries, which will include also U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano and Arizona Governor Jan Brewer, as well as representatives of fire departments from across the United States. Both Vice President Biden and Governor Brewer will speak at the event. The sole surviving member of the Granite Mountain team, Brendan McDonough, is scheduled to read an offering titled The Hot Shots Prayer. If you recall, he was one of the 20, and he was acting as a lookout for the crew about a mile away on higher ground when they were overrun by flames. So crews had managed to carve containment lines around 90% of the fire, and that's as of yesterday. So NSA leakers in the news again today because Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has asked him for a decision. If you're going to seek refuge into his country, and he held a press conference yesterday and said that he must communicate his intent to accept Venezuela's offer of asylum. And of course, he's been unable to travel further from Moscow's transit area because the United States annulled his passport. Latin American countries which have offered him asylum, including Venezuela, Bolivia, and have said that they are doing so as a collective humanitarian political asylum offer. And part two of the video that Edward Snowden did before the story went public have been released. The interview was conducted in Hong Kong on June 6th, and it was released, the first part, on Sunday, June 9th. Part two has just been released, and in it, it's kind of prescient what he said. He said he would be portrayed not as a whistleblower, but a spy, which is what is happening. And here's his quote from the interview on June 6th. I think they're going to say I have committed grave crimes. I have violated the Espionage Act. They're going to say I have aided our enemies in making them aware of these systems. But this argument can be made against anyone who reveals information that points out mass surveillance systems. And here's an interesting question. Asked whether he had a career in the intelligence community specifically to become a mole and reveal secrets, he said no. He said he joined the government service very young. First, he enlisted in the U.S. Army immediately after the invasion of Iraq out of a belief in the goodness of what we were doing. I believed in the nobility of our intentions to free oppressed people overseas. So he says that we have been misled. The public and the world has been misled, and he doesn't want to be a part of that. He has not fallen out of love with America, only its government. His quote is, America is a fundamentally good country. We have good people with good value to do the right thing, but the structures of power that exist are working to their own ends to extend their capability at the expense of the freedom of all publics. And the reason that he did it, his motivation, I don't want to live in a world where everything that I say, everything I do, everyone I talk to, every expression of creativity or love or friendship is recorded, and that's not something I'm willing to support. It's not something I'm willing to build, and it's not something I'm willing to live under. So we're going to speak with our first guest now. Again, an inspirational story, Hal Elrod, and we'll hear his story and what it means to him to have the life that he's lived.
Start your workday off right with the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Hello?
Hi, Hal. Good morning. It's Maria Sanchez. How are you?
Hey, Maria. Doing well. Good morning.
Good morning to you. So you were hit on the head by a drunk driver at 20 years of age. You were clinically dead for 6 minutes in a coma
hit
for 6 days.
Not on the head, but head on.
Oh, head on. Excuse me. Head on. Broke 11 bones and was told you may never walk again. So you have all of that bad news. You had everything wrong that could have happened to you. And what do you do as a 20-year-old young man with the rest of your life in front of you?
I think that I was faced with a choice that we're all faced with in the midst of our challenges, which is how we're going to respond, you know, and it's kind of, you can sum it up as either the victim response where you think, well, why did this happen to me and I don't deserve this and I'm a good person, or you think, you know what, the empowered response, which is, you know, I may not know why this happened to me at this point, but I have faith in myself and whether it's faith in God or just, you know, just the idea that everything happens for a reason, but it's our responsibility to choose the reasons that are going to add value to our lives and the people around us.
So how did you know to dig deep and dig down? Did you have a mentor? Did you have a counselor? Did you have somebody who was a minister? Or what, I mean, just how did you choose this path?
I had a lot of love and support and, you know, my family and everything around me. But I think the biggest thing that impacted my attitude and my response was I had started in sales about a year and a half earlier, and I did have a mentor, and he taught me something called the 5-minute rule, which I think we can all live by. And it's, you know, that when things go wrong or don't go as planned or our expectations aren't met, it's okay to be negative sometimes. Sometimes we got to vent, we got to express our emotions. But he said, set your timer for 5 minutes and, you know, bitch, moan, complain, whatever you got to do, but don't do it for more than 5 minutes. And after 5 minutes, you focus 100% of your energy and emotion and intention into what you can do to move in the direction you want to go, not wishing the past were different.
And then how did that translate into your rehabilitation? Because breaking 11 bones and being in a coma obviously has to affect your abilities.
Sure. So the doctors called my parents in one day, and unbeknownst to me, I didn't know the conversation was happening, but they called him in and they said, we're really concerned with Hal. We believe he's in denial. And we believe that because every time we see your son, every time we see Hal, he's always smiling and laughing and joking and making us laugh. And they said, that's not normal. You know, he should be sad and angry and depressed. And we want you to talk to him so he can really face the feelings and, you know, and really admit how he's feeling and experience it now and work through those emotional issues. And so my dad came in and asked me how I was feeling and shared that the doctors were concerned. And that's when I shared with him the 5-minute rule. I said, Dad, I can't change it. And now I call it my can't change it philosophy, which is that I can't change it. So there's no point in feeling bad about it. I mean, I'm going to be the happiest person. If I never walk again, I'll be the happiest person that never walks again. You know, but no matter what, I'm going to choose to be grateful for what I have, accepting of what I don't, and actively creating, you know, what I want.
So the 5-minute rule gives yourself permission to be gloomy and grumpy and depressed and sad and morose and feeling victim-like, and then you let that go.
Yeah, and I don't think the way you describe it, I don't know that you have to go that. Then you can, I guess you can, but I don't know that you have to go that deep into feeling depressed. But I think that you're feeling the way that you are, like the natural feelings that come up for you when in the midst of tragedy or losing someone. You know, I think you don't want to shut your feelings off. But ultimately, what I learned is that the key to being at peace and free from the emotional pain that we create in the midst of tragedy, the key is acceptance. And it's what I call my can't change it philosophy. I have a video and an article at can'tchangeit.com where I can explain this. But for me, it was those three words. It was can't change it. If I can't change it, the only intelligent choice I have as someone who, Maria, like all of us, we all want to be happy, right?
Mm-hmm.
I thought the only choice I have intelligently is to accept the things I can't change, because wishing and wanting that they were different only creates emotional pain for me, and it doesn't fix anything. You know, if your situation right now, if you're listening to this and your situation is challenging, you know, I went through, you know, I lost my house after the accident and, you know, and lost my job. I mean, a lot of adversity came after this, and I applied the same lessons. I thought, like, if you can't change it, the only intelligent choice that we have is to acknowledge that we can't change it, take a deep breath, and say, what can I change? And that's what we should focus all of our energy on. So what happens is after you do the 5-minute rule, after a while, you sit there and dwell on it for a couple minutes, and you go, well, why, you know, okay, it's been 2 minutes. Why am I going to keep complaining when it's not fixing anything? I'd rather make it the 5-second rule where I, you know, vent for a moment and think, okay, all right, I'm focusing right away on what I can change. And for me, it was that way. It went from the 5-minute rule to the 2-minute rule to the 1-minute rule to the 30-second rule and then to the, you know, to the accepting life before it happens rule, which is where you just decide, you know what, from now on, I'm going to stop wishing I could change things that I can't, because that doesn't help me at all.
Where does gratitude fit in?
I'm glad you asked that. When I speak, you know, I speak at high schools, colleges, companies, and when I do my keynote message, is same title as my first book. It's called Taking Life Head On. And there's what I teach is what I call the ABCs of taking life head on. The A stands for accept all things you can't change. And then right after that is the B, which is be grateful for everything. Mm. And so I think that when we are trying to be grateful, but we're fighting, wishing things were different, it doesn't create a space for us to be truly grateful, because we're resisting things. So for me, it goes right after, you accept the things you can't change, and then you immediately focus on being grateful for everything else.
And what's the C?
I thought you might have that. And the C is create consistent progress towards your dreams and goals. You know, I'm a big believer. Like I was never a writer, you know, in school, high school, college. I was the guy that couldn't get the essay done on time. You know, getting a two-page essay was a real challenge for me. So when I decided I needed to write a book and share, you know, some of the life lessons and the things I'd learned, it was really challenging. And I realized, you know what, I don't need to try to tackle the book all at once, even mentally. I just got to write a page a day. And if I write one, which I can do a page a day, I can wrap my mind around a page a day. I thought if I do one page a day, right, creating progress, then within 6 months, I'll have a 180-page book. And everything that I do now, I just try to simply, I've got my goals and dreams on paper, you know, on my wall, on my bathroom mirror, in my planner. I look at them every day. And every day I'm just asking, what's one, at least one thing I can do today to create progress towards my goals, towards my dreams? And to me, that's the formula for really living your life to the fullest. You accept the things you can't change, be grateful for everything that you have, and then create consistent progress in the direction that you want to go towards your goals and dreams.
Can we talk about your ultra marathon career running? What's that about?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a career, but absolutely.
Because you going from being told you may never walk again to being an ultra marathoner, how did you go through that progress?
So I've never run in my entire life. The only time I've ever run was when I had to run in physical, you know, PE class back in high school. Other than that, never run even a mile. And a friend of mine started a foundation called the Front Row Foundation, where they send people that are braving life-threatening illnesses to the front row of the event of their dreams, you know, concerts, sporting event, you name it. And that he had put on this marathon, and people were running the marathon and raising money, and he invited me to do it. I said, gosh, but I'm not a runner. Can I just donate money? And he said, well, why don't you just run like a 2K or run a mile, or it doesn't have to be anything. Anyway, long story short, once I committed to do this, I thought, I don't want to be one of the people that, you know, like I like to challenge myself. And I thought, you know what? What a better challenge than to be the guy that was told I'd never walk again than to run a marathon. So I committed to go for a marathon. I thought, this is crazy. And then after I started running a mile a day, getting warmed up, a friend said, you know, he had run an ultra marathon. And I thought, you know what? If I only run a marathon, I'm going to hear about it from him for the rest of my life. I only ran half as much as he did. So I thought, if I can run 26 miles, I could run 52 miles. And totally, you know, naive. And anyway, long story short, though, 6 months of training, and I ended up, you know, completing 52 miles in one day, not running the whole time. It was running, walking, jogging, crawling, limping, popping ibuprofen now and then just to be able to continue. But and then checking it off the bucket list, by the way. Never doing it again. People go, what are you going to do next? I go, I'm burning my running shoes. What do you, that was the worst day and the best day, but the worst day of my life, you know?
Hey, thank you for being realistic about that, because I have friends that do marathons. I have one girlfriend that she's done over 100. She's got a great story. She's lost 175 pounds and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And she makes it sound like, oh, it's euphoric and you get into this place. And I'm thinking, no, it's not. It's hard work. It's painful. It's got to be a bummer. But I'm glad you're doing it.
Yeah. No, it's not at all a picnic.
So how do you take then, I know how you described about your first book that you wrote and you broke it down into days / pages. How do you take it from that to being this global phenomenon that you are and that this amazing keynote speaker and inspirational person, which is, I mean, that we try and endeavor to do that with our program. We want people to not hear all the bad news and to hear some good news. And I think your case in point that you've made it happen. How did you take it to the next level? Did you get discovered, or were you wanted a message to go out so you let people know that you were available, or how did that work?
No, well, it really goes back to that C. It's just consistent progress towards my goals and dreams. It's just every day, one thing at a time. You know, my new book that just came out is really becoming the global phenomenon. I mean, it's doing 100 times better than my first book. My first book did pretty well, but the new book's just off the charts. It's called The Miracle Morning. And, you know, I've been working on that book and that movement for 5 years, you know, so you know, like I, one of my favorite quotes, and I can't remember who it was from, but they said, wow, they were told by an interviewer that, you know, you were an overnight success. You know, nobody knew who you were yesterday, and now you're just, you know, you're everywhere. And he said, it took me 10 years to become an overnight success. You know, you
right.
didn't see me, you know, getting kicked out of auditions and working at restaurants and sleeping in my car. And, you know, and I think that a lot of people, they don't, you know, they either look at the goal or the dream or the end result, and they think, you know, gosh, that's so far away. I have no idea how to go from where I am now to there. And it's because we don't go from where we are now to ultimately where we want to be. It really is one day, one step at a time, you know, and I did it one thing at a time. I mean, I launched a coaching business. That was the first thing I did when I left my sales career. I started doing success coaching, and I had to Google, how do you be a coach? And then I bought a book on how to be a coach. And then I signed up for training to be a coach. And then I learned how to get my first client. And then, you know, my first client, you know, hundreds of clients later, but it was all just one Google search at a time, you know, one book at a time. How do you write a book? Well, I Googled how to write a book, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I really think it is. The process isn't glamorous. You just got to be committed to the process without being emotionally attached to your results. I really believe that's the secret to success, Maria, is, you know, define your process, be committed to the process without being emotionally attached to the results. And like for writing a book, it's write a page a day. That's the process, you know, and some days you get writer's block. And if you're emotionally attached to that, you get discouraged and you feel like maybe you're never going to write the book. When you're training for a marathon, it's one day at a time, you know, one running day at a time. And some days you go out and you think, oh my gosh, I can't even get through a mile today. This is horrible. You can't get emotionally attached to that process. You just got to stick with it. If you want to lose weight, you know, you just keep exercising, keep eating right. And some days you're not going to lose as much weight or some weeks, but if you stay committed to the process, you don't get emotionally attached to your results. Success, I believe, is inevitable as long as you're going in the right direction.
So what is the difference in your estimation between somebody who's striving to be perfect versus somebody who strives to be authentic? And I would imagine with authenticity comes integrity.
Yeah. And I think I'm imagining you're pulling that from like my quote, you know, to give up being perfect for being authentic, or give up the need to be perfect for the opportunity to be authentic. And this was for me, you know, this was that quote came about from me kind of living through that transformation. And I think that we all, you know, we all want to look good for our other people in our lives. We want to, you know, come across as successful. And I think that's a part of, you know, I don't know if it's human nature or just maybe it's society's conditioning. But we have this need to be perfect. And I think often it prevents us from even attempting things that we have a fear that we might not be able to be perfect at.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great quote from best-selling author and leadership expert Robin Sharma that really feeds into my quote, which is, when you're vulnerable with people, they fall in love with you. And we think that we've got to be perfect, but it's really when we share our fears or our insecurities, and not in a way where we're complaining or, you know, or being a victim, but where we're just being authentic and we're, you know, even sharing a fear and how we're trying to get over it, or sharing our insecurity and how we're working through it. That's what people really connect to. And when I became a speaker, I used to be so, you know, nervous, and I had to be perfect up there. And then one day I messed up, and rather than try to play like I didn't, I actually acknowledged it, and I kind of made fun of myself, and the audience laughed and they loved it. And that was a turning point. I thought, I'm not going to be perfect anymore. I'm not going to try. I'm just going to be authentic. And if I mess up, I'm going to say I messed up. And I started living that way, and people really responded. And I found that people really, they connected with me. It allowed me to connect with them. So giving up that need to be perfect for that opportunity to be authentic, I think helps us in life, in business, in relationships, you name it.
Well, the one thing that I've noticed is that you realize that everybody's human. And so when you allow yourself to be seen as human, which is foibles and all, it's kind of refreshing, because it's like, okay, I've got permission now to be authentic, because, you know, we stumble, we fall, we struggle, we triumph, we all go through the process in our own ways. But still, it's refreshing to know that you might have a bad day every now and then, Hal.
I think we look at successful people and we even do this. We create this separation, like they must be different from me. Like their life looks perfect from the outside. And again, that's because they're trying to look perfect, right? And then you think that's how you're supposed to be. But the reality is, right, everybody's got their own mess, you know, they've all got their own issues, and and they just, you know, maybe aren't all always open about them. But yeah, I really think even the best comedians are the ones that are self-deprecating, right?
Correct.
The ones that reveal their flaws openly, that's who we love. We love them. We connect with them.
Yep. So Hal Elrod will post your contact information when we post the podcast later today, and I can't thank you enough for sharing your message with us and for the life that you've been living.
Yeah, Marie, it's an honor. Thank you for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Continued success to you.
All right. You take care.
Okay. Bye-bye. So some of his great quotes are, love the life you have while you create the life of your dreams. Don't think you have to choose one over the other. And here's another one. You are where you are because of who you were, but where you go depends entirely on who you choose to be. And then the final one, strive to make every day the best day of your life because there is no good reason not to. Okay, I have to steal one more. The moment you accept responsibility for everything in your life is the moment you can change anything in your life. So Hal Elrod, inspirational, motivational speaker, ultra-marathon runner, and his book is The Morning Miracle, the latest one. Again, we'll put that contact information up on our website. And now we're going to speak with Ellen Smoke. She is the one that's going to be talking to us about breakups and are a bitch, but getting over him doesn't have to be. Ellen's going to join us in just a moment.
The Maria Sanchez Show, a conversation, not a confrontation, on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Hello, this is Ellen.
Good morning, Ellen. It's Maria Sanchez. Welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. You're live and on the air.
Good morning, Maria. Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you? I'm really looking forward to our conversations. I was sharing with our listeners before we called you that you have your book is called Breakups Are a Bitch, but Getting Over Him Doesn't Have to Be. But it's actually a how-to for both genders, I would assume, because breakups are breakups.
It is. You know, I have a lot more. I actually have a lot more of women that gravitate towards to my work than I do men. But overall, the concept is basically the same. You know, I basically teach a process, which is a combination of work that I've learned throughout my years as a life coach, as a student of personal development, as a yoga instructor, and I've combined all of my teachings over the past 15 years into something that does work for men and women, and something that I've seen really radical shifts from, slightly different than what else is being taught out there, simply because I maybe, you know, my background is just a little bit more eclectic, so I had all sorts of teachings and trainings in my past.
And I would imagine that you've had some breakups in your life as well.
Yeah, you could say that.
I bet I have more than you.
Oh,
in fact, my daughter just said.
I think I've lost count, Maria. I really think I've lost count. In fact, I was just at a fashion show last night here in Asheville, in North Carolina, where I live, and someone was asking me what I do for a living and how I got started, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, you know, if you look around at most of the authors and experts and teachers in the world that are out and about writing books and speaking, most of us are teaching from the most raw, vulnerable place in ourselves, a place that has been taken through the mud and back. You know, it's making lemonade out of lemons. And I talk to a lot of my colleagues, and Maria, you probably relate to this as well. We really feel that we got to a breaking point in a bad relationship with our health, whatever it is that we end up teaching, and we realize that something bigger than us is at play. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is when I was in the depths of despair for my last relationship breakup, which was actually from a fiance last summer, I woke up in the middle of one night and I realized, you know, I've got to let go and surrender and trust this because something greater is at play. You know, there's a message that needs to come out of this. There are people that I need to help, and now is my chance. So yes, I have been through awful breakups. I have my book goes into this, and my work goes into this. My heart was broken, like many of us, when I was a little girl, by my father.
Oh.
And we carry that with us, and then you know we allow that to damage our self-worth and our self-love, and we go out in the world and we start dating men, and we start attracting people that keep proving to us that we have a low self-worth, or we keep attracting that person from our past that we're trying to fix, like our mother or our father.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you know, in my experience with myself, and now with the hundreds of clients that I've worked with personally, many of us never get over that initial heartbreak when we're little, and we continue to carry it on and carry it on and carry it on. And my healing process, I feel it's very divinely intertwined. I made every mistake you could possibly make with all the other breakups that I'd had. You know, I did the stalking, I did the crying, I did the driving your friends crazy. You know, I did the mm-hmm. I did all the calling and the
friends
crying
don't let friends drink and dial, right?
Exactly.
No,
so,
don't do that.
I mean, all your listeners out there who have, you know, if you're going through a breakup and you're in the midst of it, I just one thing right off the bat I want everyone to hear is that you're not alone. You know, even the strongest of us, you know, even no matter what age, no matter what wisdom, no matter what education we've had, we have all been there. And it's okay to ask, you know, reach out for help. Just make sure you're reaching out to help in the right places. Our friends they're not necessarily the ones, they usually aren't the ones that are going to give us the best advice.
Why is that? If there are friends, I would assume that's the circle that we choose to surround ourselves with love.
Well, and they do love us. And see, and therein lies the double-edged sword. They love us so much that they're only seeing our side of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes, us ladies, we are known to gab, right? We're known
right.
to sit around with our glass of wine or our coffee and talk about all the problems in the world. And you know, Dr. John Gray, who wrote Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, mm-hmm. writes about this in his book. He talks about how women actually, biologically, our stress level, our cortisol level goes down when we start talking about things.
Mm-hmm.
So, and also when we have one little thing go wrong in our life, everything else is wrong, right? We go down this well where, you know, woe is me, you know, everything's wrong in my life. And it might last for 30 minutes or an hour, and we get it out, and we feel better. And the people that we turn to in those moments are our friends. So oftentimes our friends have seen us exaggerate the problems in our relationship. They've seen us, of course, they've seen everything that we've gone through. And oftentimes we end up telling our friends more of the bad times in relationship than the good times. So when it's over or when the relationship is exiting, our friends just come to our rescue, you know, and they've heard all this garbage and they remind us of all the garbage. And also, most of us, unless we're trained as a therapist or trained as a coach or a teacher, we talk from our own experience. So
right.
Not only are your friends going to remind you of all the bad things that you've told them, but they're also going to say, well, this didn't work out for me before. And, you know, remember what Joe did to me and remember what Mike did to so-and-so. And, you know, there will be a lot of fear in those conversations with friends, not necessarily the constructive things that we need to hear. And Maria, I believe in relationships working out. You know, and I obviously not all of them are going to, and sometimes we are broken up with and we have no choice. But reaching out for relationship help in the beginning is the best thing that anyone can do. By the time we get to therapy, it's usually too late.
So are you saying within the relationship or on our own, individually, reaching out for help?
Oh, both. I think that we're on this, you know, we're in this lifetime. You know, maybe we have 80 years here, 90 years here, however long, and we are continually growing. I tell my students that change is inevitable, but growth is a choice.
Mm-hmm.
So those of us that are reaching out and reading and coaching with people and you know, listening to these types of interviews and downloading audio programs, et cetera, you know, we're on a path of personal growth. And in a relationship, that can be really, a relationship can become very, very difficult when one person is on that path and the other person isn't.
Well, it's funny because this man that I was seeing recently, who I affectionately called Mr. Wonderful, he said to me, look, I'm not going to change. I don't want you to change me, and I'll give you that same respect. And I said, au contraire, I expect to change throughout the rest of my life. I want to evolve and grow and change. And he went, oh, that change. And I was like, yeah, that change. So I don't know if maybe that was a fundamental difference initially, because as it turns out, he did want to change me.
Absolutely. And it is fundamental, and it still doesn't make it any easier, right? We could be already be in love with someone or already be in some serious like with someone when we start to learn these things. And instead of necessarily looking at it as a loss, I would encourage you and everyone listening to look at it as a gain. You know, these soulmates come in and out of our life, and they're not necessarily meant to live forever or be with us forever. In my opinion, a soulmate is someone who progresses you along that path of evolution in your life and personal awareness and personal growth, personal enlightenment. So if someone comes in your life and inspires you to become a better person, maybe by living by example, or maybe they're that person that's totally, you know, nothing's wrong with them, right? Everything's
right.
Wrong with you. They're not, and,
right.
You know, they're fine, and they don't need to grow. That can be an inspiration. That can be a catalyst to go, you know what, I don't want to be like you. I do want to evolve. I do want to grow. Thank you for setting me free. You know, rejection. Mm-hmm. Rejection can be our friend because it answers that question that all of us have in a relationship. And that question is he the one or is she the one? You know, am I going to marry this person? So when we're rejected, we are literally set free to go out and find that person who's waiting for us to continue to evolve.
Well, according to my daughter, I've exceeded the lifetime limit. So she says,
oh,
now I just adopted a rescue cat about 10 days ago. And she goes, so just get more cats. It's enough already.
Oh,
I said,
my goodness.
She's in college. And
we,
so
have
she came
that.
Home.
We have that in common, Maria. I've been calling myself a foster failure lately. I tried to rescue kittens and nurse them back to health. And I was successful with three. And then a cute little calico came around. And I couldn't give her away. I was a total foster failure.
Oh, yeah. No, mine's adoption for life because the poor little thing, she had babies too young, and you know she's had a hard, hard, hard life. And so I keep promising her, you've hit the jackpot now. You don't have to have a care or concern in your life anymore. So, I guess maybe that's the good thing. So I said to my daughter when she came home over the weekend, and this had all just gone down. She says, you know. I said to her, you know, some girls get to come home and they talk to their mom about her, you know, handicap with her golf game and about the philanthropy that she's doing and how her career is going. And you get to talk to your mom about her breakup. She's like, yep, I know. So it wasn't what I wished.
How old is your daughter, Maria? I'm curious.
She's 21.
Okay. That's such a great age to have those kind of conversations with her. I think that's such a blessing. I mean, she can... she's going to learn so much about relationship, having a mother that is single and out there dating and getting her heart broken and, mm-hmm. and going through the same trials and tribulations that she's going through. I think you're probably passing down quite a bit of wisdom from her. And she may have told you that you've run out of soulmates in this lifetime, but we need to get her on the phone, and I'm going to tell her otherwise.
I'm sure she was being facetious, but I also know she was being protective because she's sick of hearing or seeing her mother be hurt. Now, to my credit, I don't let spill out my guts to her if she's my daughter. You know, I mean, she doesn't get to see the warts like my girlfriends do. But, you know, she hears me speak, hopefully, about, you know, oh, yes, and then yes, and then yes, and then it's like, no. Okay, so I know that she's... you know, it's fiercely protective of me, which I appreciate. But I want her still to be the daughter. I'm her mother. She's not my friend. She's, you know, not my counselor. I'm very clear about those boundaries between us.
Right.
Even though I do share.
Tell me, Maria, what is a breakup? What are some of the first things that you do after you've been broken up with? Because this just happened recently for you, right?
Right, over the weekend.
Okay.
So I instantly go to my posse of girlfriends and just get some commiseration or some solace, and maybe support, if you will. And then we usually go to the line, okay, so now it's time to become a nun or a lesbian.
We always go to the world. We have sometimes have to go really far in that really negative direction in order to realize, this isn't right. I don't want to be over here.
Well, because, and then one of my girlfriends said, no, Maria, lesbians date too. So you're not going to escape.
So none is the option. Okay, yes. So we have a winner.
So, and then I don't suck my thumb for very long. You know, I think that life is a beautiful thing and that this is the path, and I've got, I have four fabulous children. I live in gratitude and there's abundance of prosperity in my life, and I focus on that, and this too shall pass.
I just love what you just said. And if I could have written it faster, I would have written it down. And you touched on two things that just gave me, I have goosebumps, I have chicken skin on my arms right now. When I hear the word gratitude, and abundance. Two things that are talked about in all sorts of communities, right? The relationship community, the financial community. It's pretty much any self-help type book that you pick up will talk about gratitude and abundance. And Maria, I was teaching these things for years and studying these things for years, and I don't know if I really understood the power of both of those things until losing my fiancé last summer.
I'm so sorry.
I was grateful, and I knew that there was abundance. But sometimes you have to go through a really dark place of feeling ungrateful for everything because you don't feel like you have anything left, right? Mm-hmm. And thinking that there is nothing left. You know, there is nothing more that'll come your way.
That is the great unknown, right? There are no guarantees.
I had met my fiance, my ex-fiance, back in the year 2001. We had a short little dating fling, just had fun, went out a few times. And then that was in Atlanta. I was living in Atlanta, and I moved all the way across the country a couple months later to San Diego. And I lived out there for close to 7 years. And he looked me up 7 years later and sent me an email. And we had a romance over the phone and fell in love. And, you know, it was one of those encounters where you think the stars have lined up and the birds
right.
are chirping in your
right.
name. And, you know, and flowers are blooming, everything's singing around you.
Yes, yes.
He was the one, right?
Right.
And he was a soulmate. He might have been more than that for me, since we keep coming back around. And I moved back across the country to be with him, and was with him for 5 years. And we ended up working together. We lived together. Which is a whole other discussion. If you wanted to talk another day about how to keep your work life and your love life separately, that's another great conversation. But John and I, we really still needed to do some work. He had some fears that he needed to get over. I had some insecurities that I needed to get over. And throughout the course of that relationship, we definitely evolved, but unfortunately we started to take out all of our skeletons in the closet out on each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we really needed to break in order to do what I call break up. And I call it break up brilliance, but if you can use a relationship as a catalyst to really break up into your most brilliant version of yourself possible, I see it all the time. Now, I also see the opposite of that, and I see relationships breaking people down internally, and really
yes.
just, you know, it's like killing a little part of your spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to circle back to gratitude and abundance. I think that those two things are the difference between what happens and how two people, let's take the example of the person that breaks up into her brilliance, and the person that breaks down and just, you know, lets it with their spirit. Those two people are, one is practicing gratitude and abundance and one isn't.
Interesting.
And it's becoming clearer to me the more people I talk to. And, you know, both are, both cases and both paths are a bit circumstantial. It is what you've been taught before. It's the type of people that you surround yourself with. There's a saying that says you become like the five people that you surround yourself with the most. So if you're surrounded by people that are practicing gratitude and abundance during your hard time, the better off you're going to be. You know, they're going to be the catalyst for you. Two of the practices that I did, I put myself in what I call timeout after my last breakup because I realized I had never really truly healed. Done what I call now heal for real.
And Ellen, we're running out of time, so I'm curious if we can continue the conversation at another time. Because another element that we haven't touched on is strong women and accomplished women and how that challenges relationships too.
Absolutely. And I'll,
so I will be back in touch with you. Thank you so much. And your contact information, what would you like to share that would be the best?
You can reach me at a website called breakupsareabitch.com, and I'll also leave my phone number. It's area code 404-797-5533.
Okay, we'll post that later today when we post the podcast. So, Ellen, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for calling. We'll talk again, hopefully, and lots of love to you and everyone else.
Thank you, Ellen. Ellen, take care. And this is the Maria Sanchez Show. We post the podcast later today, the download information as well. Thank you so much for listening. Have a fabulous day, and we look forward to visiting with you mañana.
Give you some